which tightened the bolt on the racist stereotype linking black women to big buttocks. Polygenesis Charles White had already tightened the bolt linking black men with big genitalia. Retiring colonial official Alexander Dunlop and Bartman's South African master Hendrik Caesars brought Bartman to London in July 1810. Upon Dunlop's death in 1814, exhibitor Henry Taylor brought the 36 or 37-year-old Bartman to Paris for another round of shows. Papers rejoiced over her arrival. She appeared in the Grand Palais Royal, the centerfold of Parisian debauchery, where prostitutes mixed with printers, restaurants with gambling houses, coffee gossipers with drunk dancers, beggars with elites. On November 19, 1814, Parisians strolled into the Vaudeville Theater across from the Palais Royal to view the opening of La Vénus Hottentote, or The Hatred of French Women. In the opera's plot, a young Frenchman does not find his suitor sufficiently exotic. When she appears, disguised as the Hottentot Venus, he falls in love. Securing his attraction, she drops the disguise. The Frenchman drops the ridiculous attraction to the Hottentot Venus, comes to his senses, and the couple marries. The opera revealed Europeans' ideas about black women. After all, when Frenchmen are seduced by the Hottentot Venus, they are acting like animals. When Frenchmen are attracted to French women, they are acting rationally. While hypersexual black women are worthy of sexual attraction, asexual French women are worthy of love and marriage. In January 1815, animal showman S. Rowe obtained Bartman from Henry Taylor. Rowe paraded her sometimes with a collar around her neck at cafes, at restaurants, and in soirees for Parisian elites, wherever there was money. One day in March 1815, Rowe shepherded Bartman to the Museum of Natural History in Paris, which housed the world's greatest collection of natural objects. They had a meeting with Europe's most distinguished intellectual, the comparative anatomist Georges Cuvier. That rare segregationist who rejected polygenesis, Cuvier believed that all humans descended from Europe's Garden of Eden. A catastrophic event 5,000 years earlier had sent the survivors fleeing to Asia and Africa. Three races had emerged and had started passing on unchangeable hereditary traits. The white race was the most beautiful of all and was superior, according to Cuvier. The African's physical features approximated it to the monkey tribe. In his lab, Cuvier asked Bartman to take off her long skirt and shawl, which she had worn to ward off the March wind. Bartman refused. Startled, Cuvier did all he could to document her with her clothes on over the next 3 days, measuring and drawing her body. Sometime in late December 1815, Bartman died, perhaps of pneumonia. No black woman was the subject of more obituaries in Parisian newspapers in the 19th century than Sarah Bartman. Cuvier secured his corpse and brought her to his laboratory. He removed her clothes, cracked open her chest wall, removed and studied all of her major organs. Cuvier spread her legs, studied her buttocks, and cut out her genitals, setting them aside for preservation. After Cuvier and his team of scientists finished their scientific rape, they boiled off the rest of Bartman's flesh. They reassembled the bones into a skeleton. Cuvier then added her remains to his world-famous collection. In his report, he claimed to have never seen a human head more resembling a monkey's than hers. The Khoi people of South Africa, he concluded, were more closely related to the ape than to the human. Parisians displayed Bartman's skeleton, genitals, and brain until 1974. When President Nelson Mandela took office in 1994, he renewed South Africans' calls for Bartman's return home. France returned her remains to her homeland in 2002. After a life and afterlife of unceasing exhibition, Bartman finally rested in peace. Bartman's fate was particularly horrific in the early 1810s, and Cuvier's conclusions about black bodies were consumed with little hesitation by those seeking evidence of black inferiority to justify their commerce on both sides of the Atlantic, a commerce taking root in the wombs of black women. No matter what Thomas Jefferson said to Henry Graywall in 1809, black people were not gaining daily in the opinions of the Choctaws and Chickasaws who started acquiring them or were re-enslaving runaways. While these indigenous southern slaveholders rejected ideas of white superiority and Native American inferiority, they embraced associations of blackness with slavery. enslaved Africans in Jefferson's Louisiana Territory were not gaining daily in the opinions of their French and American masters either. And these captives refused to wait until their French and American masters gained an emancipatory opinion of them, knowing they could be waiting forever for their freedom. On January 8, 1811, about 15 captives on the sugar plantation in an area known as the German Coast wounded a planter, Major Manuel Andry, and killed his son. Bearing military uniforms and guns, cane knives, and axes, while beating drums and waving flags, they started marching from plantation to plantation, swelling their numbers and the dead bodies of enslavers. In time, between 200 and 500 biracial and African people had joined the 35-mile Freedom March to invade New Orleans. Led by Asante warriors Kwamana and Cook, along with biracial men Harry Kenner and Charles Deslons, and inspired by the Haitian Revolution, these revolutionaries waged the largest slave revolt in the history of the United States. On January 10, 1811, the poorly armed band of freed people were defeated by a well-armed band of 400 militiamen and 60 U.S. Army troops. In the end, almost 100 former captives were killed or executed. Louisiana provided reparations for the planters, $300, about $4,200 in 2014 for each captive killed. Authorities whacked off their heads and strung them up for all to see at intervals from New Orleans to Andry's plantation. Hoping for assurances of federal protection in case of future rebellions, Louisiana sugar planters voted to join the Union in 1812. With the addition of Louisiana, another slave state, it became clear that slavery was expanding, not contracting, as Jefferson left office. The number of enslaved Africans swelled 70% in 20 years, increasing from 697,897 in the first federal census of 1790 to 1,191,354 in 1810, before tripling over the next 50 years. The escalation of slavery and the need to defend it against anti-American abolitionists in Europe generated one of the first waves of pro-slavery thought after the Revolution. Even Northerners, or native Northerners living in the South, defended it. In 1810, future Pennsylvania Congressman Charles Jared Ingersoll released Inchiquin, the Jesuits' Letters, refuting the aspersions cast upon slavery by former residents and tourists. A few years later, New York anti-slavery novelist James Kirk Paulding tried to defend his nation and the slow pace of change. Freeing happy Africans could endanger the community, undermine property rights, and render them more wretched than they already were, Paulding wrote. Philadelphia Federalist Robert Walsh published An Appeal from the Judgments of Great Britain Respecting the United States of America in 1819. Your work will furnish the first volume of every future American history, Thomas Jefferson accurately predicted. Though Walsh blamed the British for slavery, he said the institution endeared masters with sensibility, justice, and steadfastness. For the African, whose color is a perpetual memento of their servile origin, their enslavement is positively good. The slave was exempt from those racking anxieties experienced by the English. If Jefferson truly desired to see a refutation of his racist ideas in notes, as he told Grewal, then he had made no moves in that direction during his presidency, neither politically nor in print. His most pressing personal concern in 1809 was moving back home to the comfort of Monticello and Sally Hemings and away from the ongoing political parade in Washington. Jefferson left Washington a week after his close friend and mentee James Madison was installed as the fourth president of the United States on March 4, 1809. Jefferson's presidential reign did not end with his departure from Washington. Until 1841, a series of self-described disciples of Jefferson served as U.S. presidents, the lone exception being John Quincy Adams in the late 1820s. In 1809, Jefferson estimated his net worth to be $225,000, roughly $3.3 million in 2014, based on 10,000 acres of land, a manufacturing mill, 200 slaves, and a mountain of debt. Whether he was pro-slavery or anti-slavery, Jefferson needed slavery in 1809 to maintain his financial solvency and life of luxury. In the initial years of his retirement, Jefferson finally finished his 11,000-square-foot, 33-room mansion displaying all the things he had collected. The animal specimens and Native American objects, the medals and maps, the portraits and sculptures of Jesus, Benjamin Franklin, John Locke, Sir Isaac Newton, Christopher Columbus, and Voltaire, and the painting of himself drawn by Boston painter Mather Brown, a descendant of Cotton Mather. Loving retirement, Jefferson placed books on top of newspapers. He did not have to leave Monticello, and he rarely did. He had a plantation to run, which relied on slave labor to pay off his debts, or rather, pay for the luxuries he loved. He put science, not politics, at the center of his affairs, emerging as America's celebrity scholar in the 1810s. The requests for advice and data and the reviewing of manuscripts seemed endless. From sunrise to 1 or 2 o'clock, and often from dinner to dark, "I am drudging at the writing table," Jefferson complained to John Adams. He was not updating notes, though. By 1813, he had lost all drive to reproduce his ideas. Jefferson had also lost all drive to support the cause of anti-slavery. In 1814, Edward Coles, the personal secretary of President James Madison, asked Jefferson to arouse public sentiment against slavery. Jefferson balked, using the excuse of old age. The 71-year-old advised Coles to reconcile himself with enslavement and only promote emancipation in a way that did not offend anyone. Ironically, the inoffensive solution that Jefferson offered in notes, and that he tried to execute once as president, was about to be adopted by a new generation. Chapter 12. Colonization. One of Thomas Jefferson's most enduring legacies was a race relations effort that spanned the course of the 19th century. It all began in the spring of 1800 in Jefferson's home state. Two captives, Gabriel and Nancy Prosser, were organizing a slave rebellion. Standing well over 6 feet tall, with dark skin, penetrating eyes, and bulging scars, the 24-year-old Gabriel Prosser caught people's attention wherever he went. He won converts by reminding them of the Haitian armies that had turned back the armies of Spain, England, and France. The Prossers planned to have hundreds of captives march on Richmond, where they would seize 4,000 unguarded muskets, arrest Governor James Monroe, hold the city until reinforcements arrived from surrounding counties, and negotiate the end of slavery and equal rights. The lives of friendly Methodists, Quakers, and French people were to be spared, but racist blacks would be killed. Allies were to be recruited among Virginia's poor whites and Native Americans. The revolt failed to materialize on the planned date of Saturday, August 30th, 1800. Two cynical slaves begging for their master's favor betrayed what would have been the largest slave revolt in the history of North America, with as many as 50,000 rebels joining in from as far as Norfolk, Virginia. Given notice that afternoon, Governor James Monroe dispatched Richmond's defenses and informed every militia commander in Virginia. Wind and rain stormed through the Virginia Tidewater. A capsized bridge halted the march of 1,000 armed rebels into the city. The liberating army disbanded, dripping in disgust. The enslaving army stayed intact, over the next few weeks invading communities and arresting rebel leaders. Gabriel Prosser fled to Norfolk, where he was betrayed and captured on September 25th. Dragged back to Richmond, he was hanged along with his comrades, but they appeared defiant until the end. The accused have exhibited a spirit which, if it becomes general, must deluge the southern country in blood, said an eyewitness. A rebellious slave was extraordinary, real, but not really representative. During the final months of 1800, enslavers blasted the racist mantra of the contented slave in public by demanding more weapons, more organization, and more sophisticated laws to restrain them. On December 31st, 1800, the Virginia House of Delegates secretly instructed Governor James Monroe to correspond with the incoming President Jefferson on finding lands outside of Virginia where persons dangerous to the peace of society may be removed. Jefferson requested clarity on their desires on November 24, 1801. He suggested colonization in the Caribbean or Africa to the Virginia delegates, expressing the improbability of securing lands within the continental United States. Virginia lawmakers again gathered in secret in 1802 to respond to their native son. Slavery had to continue, and its natural byproduct, resistance, had to stop. So Virginia lawmen took Jefferson up on his proposal, asking him to find a foreign home for the state's free blacks. Jefferson went to work, inquiring through intermediaries about West Africa's Sierra Leone, England's colony for freed people since 1792. England spurned Jefferson, as did other European nations. Breaking the bad news to Monroe on December 27, 1804, Jefferson assured him he would keep it under my constant attention. Virginia lawmakers swore themselves to secrecy, agreeing to never reveal their maneuvers for colonization. They did not even inform the next generation of lawmakers. But in 1816, Charles Fenton Mercer, a member of the House of Delegates since 1810, learned of Jefferson's plan. He uncovered the correspondence between Monroe and Jefferson, and he was inspired by the Jeffersonian rationale for sending blacks abroad. Mercer was an anti-slavery, anti-abolitionist slaveholder like Jefferson. "Although slavery is wrong," he later wrote, "emancipation would do more harm than good." Mercer wanted to remake his region's agrarian slave labor economy into a free labor, industrial economy. He dreaded the working class revolts that were picking up steam in Western Europe, but had faith in the ability of a public education system to placate lower and middle income whites. Yet he recognized that the rampant racial discrimination in America would fashion free blacks into a perpetually rebellious working class. He wanted to expel blacks from the United States before it was too late. Colonization seemed like a godsend to Mercer. It also appealed to Robert Finley, who learned about the cause from his brother-in-law, Mercer's old friend Elias B. Caldwell, the longtime clerk of the U.S. Supreme Court. An anti-slavery clergyman, Finley had already taken an interest in the plight of low-income free blacks, and to him, colonization seemed to be the perfect solution to their problems. Mercer, Finley, and the colonizationists they inspired ended up being the ideological children of an odd couple who had disliked each other, Thomas Jefferson and Samuel Stanhope Smith. The latter endorsed the cause before his 1819 death. While Smith believed that black people were capable of whiteness, Jefferson insisted that they were incapable of achieving whiteness in the United States. Colonization offered an alternative that both men could embrace. In 1816, Finley sat down and wrote the colonization movement's manifesto, Thoughts on the Colonization of Free Blacks. "What shall we do with the free people of color?" he began the pamphlet. "Free blacks must be trained for self-government and returned to their land of origin," he wrote. "For the enslaved, the evil of slavery will be diminished, and in a way so gradual as to prepare the whites for the happy and progressive change." Carrying this literary cannonball of racist ideas, Finley invaded Washington, D.C. in late November 1816. He lobbied journalists, politicians, and President James Madison, whose views on blacks mirrored Jefferson's. Finley and his powerful associates called an organizational meeting for colonizationists on December 21, 1816. Presiding was Kentucky Representative Henry Clay, whose early life had resembled Thomas Jefferson's. Born to Virginia planters, Clay had become a lawyer, a Kentucky planter, and then a politician. He had expressed an early abolitionism that had faded with time. Clay had just finished his second stint as Speaker of the House when he presided over the colonization meeting that birthed the American Colonization Society. Slaveholder and Supreme Court Justice Bushrod Washington, the nephew of George Washington, was elected president of the society, and the vice presidents included Finley, Clay, General Andrew Jackson, and Mercer's Princeton schoolmate Richard Rush, the son of Benjamin Rush, who had pledged his support for colonization before his death in 1813. At the inaugural meeting, Finley's gradual abolitionism took a back seat to the demands of the slaveholders. The society would ignore the delicate question of abolition and only promote the deportation of free blacks, Henry Clay said. "Can there be a nobler cause than that which, whilst it proposed to rid our country of a useless and pernicious, if not dangerous portion of its population, contemplates the spreading of the arts of civilized life and the possible redemption from ignorance and barbarism of a benighted quarter of the globe?" Newspapers around the nation reprinted his words. In Philadelphia, at least 3,000 black men packed into Mother Bethel AME Church on January 15, 1817, to discuss the ACS's formation. Longtime colonization supporter James Fortin, AME Church founder Richard Allen, and two other black ministers pledged their support for colonization and its missionary potential. Speeches concluded, Fortin stepped to the pulpit to gauge the crowd. "Those in favor?" Fortin asked. No one spoke. No one raised a hand. "Nothing." "All opposed?" Fortin nervously asked. "Everything." A booming no rang out, shaking the walls of the church. These black men had walked into the church fuming. Their wives, girlfriends, sisters, and mothers were probably angry too, but were disallowed from proclaiming it at the male-only meeting. The meeting attendees audaciously denounced the unmerited stigma that Henry Clay had cast upon the reputation of the free people of color. They did not want to go to the savage wilds of Africa, the attendees resolved, demonstrating that they had already consumed those racist myths. But at the same time, they were expressing their commitment to enslaved people and America and demanding recognition for their role in the nation's growth. It was the land of our nativity, a land that had been manured by their blood and sweat. "We will never separate ourselves voluntarily from the slave population of this country," they resolved. American-born descendants of Africa judged the continent based on the standards they had learned from the very people who were calling them inferior and trying to kick them out of the United States. Africans in America had received their knowledge of Africa and their racist ideas from white Americans, and white Americans' racist ideas had been procured from a host of European writers, everyone from Sarah Bartman's dissector Georges Cuvier of France to philosopher Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel of Germany. Around the time of the American Colonization Society founding, European nations were increasingly turning their capital and guns from the slave trade to the cause of colonizing Africa as well as Asia. English, French, German, and Portuguese armies fought African armies throughout the 19th century, trying to establish colonies in order to exploit Africa's resources and bodies more systematically and efficiently. This new racist drive required racist ideas to make sense of it, and Hegel's pontifications about backward Africans arrived right on time. Racist ideas always seemed to arrive right on time to dress up the ugly economic and political exploitation of African people. Ironically, back in 1807, Hegel had expressed a very anti-racist idea in his classic book Phenomenology of Spirit, condemning the overhasty judgment formed at first sight about the inner nature and character of a person. He revolutionized European philosophy and history in many important matters in the 19th century. Legions of philosophy chairs across Europe became Hegelians, and the philosophers he influenced, including men like Søren Kierkegaard, Karl Marx, and Friedrich Engels, reached like a who's who of European intellectuals. But before his death in 1831, Hegel failed to free himself and Europe from the Enlightenment era's racist ideas. It is the concrete universal self-determining thought which constitutes the principle and character of Europeans, Hegel once wrote. God becomes man, revealing himself. In contrast, African people, he said, were a nation of children in the first stage of human development. The Negro is an example of animal man in all his savagery and lawlessness. They could be educated, but they would never advance on their own. Hegel's foundational racist idea justified Europe's ongoing colonization of Africa. European colonizers would supposedly bring progress to Africa's residents, just as European enslavers had brought progress to Africans in the Americas. In their resolution against the American Colonization Society, Philadelphia blacks noted the unmerited stigma that had been cast upon the reputation of the free people of color. The death of Robert Finley later in the year strained the ACS, and it struggled to attract federal funding and the support of slaveholders, especially in the Deep South. The slaveholders would never accept colonization unless they were convinced that it would allow slavery to endure. Free blacks would never sign on unless emancipation was promised. Neither group was satisfied. Still, the society was persistent. In terms of federal funding, Charles Fenton Mercer steered the next offensive after adjoining the House of Representatives. On January 13, 1819, Mercer introduced the Slave Trade Act, which allocated $100,000 to send Negroes back to Africa. Signing the bill into law was the old Virginia governor sympathetic to colonization, James Monroe, who had been elected to the U.S. presidency weeks before the formation of the ACS. Almost immediately, debates sprang up as to whether the bill authorized Monroe to acquire land in Africa. By 1821, Monroe had dispatched U.S. Naval Officer Robert Stockton as an agent of the Society to West Africa. With a drawn pistol in one hand and a pen in the other, Stockton embezzled, some say for $300, a strip of Atlantic coastal land south of Sierra Leone from a local ruler, who probably did not hold title to his people's land. The United States thus joined the growing band of nations seeking to colonize Africa. By 1824, American settlers had built fortifications there. They renamed the settlement Liberia, and its capital, Monrovia, after the U.S. president. Between 1820 and 1830, only 154 black northerners out of more than 100,000 sailed to Liberia. The 19th century had begun with the slave rebellion plot that had caused Virginia enslavers and President Jefferson to think seriously of sending free or enslaved blacks back to Africa. The slave rebellions kept coming, and nothing accelerated enslavers' support for the colonization movement more than actual or potential slave rebellions. In 1818, a 51-year-old free carpenter named Denmark Vesey started recruiting the thousands of slaves in and around Charleston that would form his army. One estimate says 9,000. Vesey was well known locally as one of the founders of Emmanuel EME Church, the first African Methodist Episcopal Church in the South. Before receiving his freedom in 1800, Vesey had traveled the Atlantic with his seafaring owner, acquiring a tremendous pride in the agency, culture, and humanity of African people. He had also been inspired by the American, French, and Haitian revolutions. Vesey likely spent time teaching, motivating, and encouraging fellow enslaved blacks and challenging the racist ideas they had consumed, perhaps regularly reciting the biblical story of the Israelites' deliverance from Egyptian bondage. He set the revolt for July 14, 1822, the anniversary of the French Revolution. Trusted house servants were to assassinate top South Carolina officials as they slept. Six infantry and cavalry companies were to invade the city and kill every white and black antagonist they encountered on sight. Arsonists were to burn the city to the ground. Spared captains of ships were to bring the rebels to Haiti or Africa, not as colonizers, but as immigrants. House slave Peter Priolo betrayed the plot in late May. He received a reward of freedom and later became a slaveholder himself. Priolo had no desire to abolish slavery, and he probably did not question the racist ideas behind it. In four long years of recruiting thousands of rebels, no mistakes had been made by Vesey's lieutenants. No one betrayed the plot, an amazing organizational feat, until Priolo opened his mouth. By late June, South Carolina authorities had destroyed Vesey's army, banished 34 of Vesey's soldiers, and hanged 35 men, including Denmark Vesey himself, who was defiant to the very end. The vast Vesey conspiracy provoked fear in Charleston and beyond. Slaveholders began to contemplate the end of slavery, and ejecting the black people seemed like an attractive option. In the words of one writer, the whole United States should join in a colonization society. Another Charleston essayist who endorsed colonization pledged that he was ready to help free the country of so unwelcome a burden. Instead, new laws tightening the noose on enslaved blacks soothed the raw fear. Officials stipulated that enslaved blacks should only wear Negro cloth, a cheap, coarse cotton sometimes mixed with wool. Every distinction should be created between the whites and the Negroes, a jurist said, to make the latter feel the superiority of the former. Until 1822, until Denmark Vesey, Northerners had produced most of the racist books and tracts defending slavery. Writers like Charles Jared Ingersoll, James Kirk Paulding, and Robert Walsh, all from the North, defended slavery from British onslaughts in the 1810s. On October 29, 1822, Charleston Times editor Edwin Clifford Holland released the first pro-slavery treatise by a native Southerner. Enslaved Africans, he said, could never affect any revolution because of their general inferiority in the gifts of nature. He was trying to calm his worried fellows. But they could disrupt society, he said, and whites should always be on guard. Let it never be forgotten that our Negroes are the anarchists and the domestic enemy, the common enemy of civilized society and the barbarians who would, if they could, become destroyers of our race. Holland did not include the industrious, sober, hard-working, and free biracial people in this denunciation. In the event of a rebellion, Holland believed they would form a barrier between our own color and that of the black because they were more likely to enlist themselves under the banners of the whites. Thomas Jefferson probably expected rebellions like Denmark Vesey's, and he probably expected grandiose betrayals like Peter Priolo's. He did not expect the Missouri Question. Weeks after Charles Fenton Mercer introduced the Slave Trade Act that led to America's first colony in Africa, his New York colleague James Talmadge Jr. tacked an amendment onto a bill admitting Missouri to the Union that would have barred the admission of enslaved Africans into the new state. The Talmadge Amendment sparked a smoldering fire of debate that burned for 2 years. Ultimately, it was tempered, but not extinguished, by the Missouri Compromise of 1820. Congress agreed to admit Missouri as a slave state and Maine as a free state, and to prohibit the introduction of slavery in the northern section of the vast Louisiana Territory that Jefferson had purchased from France. Thomas Jefferson did not make much of the early Missouri Question debate. He expected it to pass like waves in a storm pass under the ship. When the storm did not pass, he became worried, and he soon described the storm as the most portentous one which ever yet threatened our Union. By 1820, he was warning of a civil war that could become a racial war, and that could then develop into a war of extermination toward the African in our land. The Missouri Question had roused Jefferson like a fire bell in the night, as he told Massachusetts Congressman John Holmes on April 22, 1820. "I considered it at once," he wrote, "the nail of the Union." He gave Holmes his stump speech on emancipation. No man wanted it more than him, but no workable plan for compensating owners and colonizing the freed had been put forth. "As it is," he said, "we have the wolf by the ears, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go." What could be done? Justice is in one scale, and self-preservation in the other. Jefferson, the nation's most famous anti-slavery anti-abolitionist, longed for the Louisiana Territory that he purchased in 1803 to become the Republic's hospital, the place where the illnesses of the original states could be cured, most notably the illness of slavery. Enslaved Africans would be spread out in the vast Louisiana Territory if not sent to Africa. The diffusion of enslaved Africans over a greater surface would make them individually happier and proportionately facilitate the accomplishment of their emancipation by dividing the burden on a great number of coadjutors. Jefferson dreamed that the vast Louisiana Territory could swallow slavery. Spread enslaved Africans out and they will go away. Jefferson adamantly came to believe that black freedom should not be discussed in the white halls of Congress, and that Southerners should be left alone to solve the problem of slavery at their own pace, in their own way. In his younger years, he had considered gradual emancipation and colonization to be the solution. His gradualism turned into procrastination. In his final years, Jefferson said that on the subject of emancipation, "I have ceased to think because it is not to be the work of my day." Slavery had become too lucrative to too many slaveholders for emancipation to be Jefferson's work of those days. For Jefferson, the Missouri Question was personal. If slavery could not continue its Western expansion, his finances might be affected by the decreased demand for enslaved Africans in the domestic slave trade. As he agonized over the future livelihood of the United States and his own economic prospects, Jefferson could not have helped but think of the nation's past and his own past, and how both had reached this point of no return. 77 years old in 1721, Jefferson decided to state some recollections of dates and facts concerning myself. The autobiography of Thomas Jefferson runs less than 100 pages and ends when he becomes U.S. Secretary of State in 1790. In this work, Jefferson attempted once again to secure his anti-slavery credentials after training for a lifetime as a slaveholder. "Nothing is more certainly written in the Book of Fate than that these people are to be free," he wrote. "Nor is it less certain that the two races equally free cannot live in the same government. Nature, habit, opinion has drawn indelible lines of distinction between them." In 40 years, nothing had diminished his need to produce racist ideas. Not the black exhibitions, Uplift Suasion, letters from abolitionists, Sally Hemings, or the loyalty or the resistance of enslaved Africans. Jefferson shared the same view in his autobiography in 1821 that he had in notes in 1781. He promoted the colonization idea, that freed blacks be hauled away to Africa in the same manner that enslaved blacks had been hauled to America. In the 1820s, the American Colonization Society grew into the preeminent race relations reform organization in the United States. Jefferson was again endorsing colonization, and calculating segregationists were beginning to see it as a solution to black resistance. Altruistic assimilationists figured that it was a way to develop black people in both America and Africa. In 1825, a 28-year-old Yale alumnus, Ralph Gurley, became the new ACS secretary. He held the position until his death in 1872, while also serving twice as the chaplain of the House of Representatives. Gurley had a vision. He believed that to win the minds and souls of Americans to the colonization cause, it had to be linked to the Protestant movement. His timing was good, because the Second Great Awakening was at hand as he began his ACS post. The American Bible Society, the American Sunday School Union, and the American Tract Society were all established in this period, and they each used the printing press to besiege the nation with Bibles, tracts, pictures, and picture cards that would help to create a strong, unified, Jesus-centered national identity. "A good tract should be entertaining," announced the American Tract Society in 1824. "There must be something to allure the listless to read." Allurement, those pictures of holy figures, had long been considered a sinful trick of Satan and devilish Catholics. No more. Protestant organizations started mass-producing, mass-marketing, and mass-distributing images of Jesus, who was always depicted as white. Protestants saw all the aspirations of the new American identity in the white Jesus, a racist idea that proved to be in their cultural self-interest. As pictures of this white Jesus started to appear, blacks and whites started to make connections, consciously and unconsciously, between the white God, the Father, his white son Jesus, and the power and perfection of white people. "I really believed my old master was Almighty God," runaway Henry Brown admitted, "and that his son, my young master, was Jesus Christ." As the revived Protestant movement ignited the enthusiasm of students, professors, clergymen, merchants, and legislators in New England, the American Colonization Society drew more people into its fold. While Southern colonizationists sought to remove free blacks, Northerners sought to remove all blacks, enslaved and freed. Northern race relations had grown progressively worse since the 1790s, defying uplift suasion. Each uplifting step of black people stoked animosity, and runaways stoked further animosity. Race riots embroiled New York City, New Haven, Boston, Cincinnati, and Pittsburgh in the 1820s. As racial tensions accumulated, the ACS continued to gain adherence to the cause. Its agents argued forcefully that white prejudice and black slavery would be eternal, and that freed blacks must use the talents they had acquired from whites to go back and redeem unenlightened Africa. By 1832, every northern state legislature had passed resolutions of endorsement for the colonization idea. Free blacks remained overwhelmingly against colonization. Their resistance to the concept partly accounted for the identifier Negro replacing African in common usage in the 1820s. Free blacks theorized that if they called themselves African, they would be giving credence to the notion that they should be sent back to Africa. Their own racist ideas were also behind the shift in terminology. They considered Africa and its cultural practices to be backward, having accepted racist notions of the continent. Some light-skinned blacks preferred colored to separate themselves from dark-skinned Negroes or Africans. For many, the colonization movement gave a new urgency to the idea of uplift suasion. Racist free blacks thought uplift suasion offered black people a way to prove their worthiness to white elites. In 1828, Boston preacher Hosea Easton urged a Thanksgiving Day crowd of Rhode Island black folk to come out of this degrading course of life. By uplifting themselves, they would demand respect from those who exalt themselves above you. As part of the renewed effort to promote uplift suasion, a group of free blacks established the nation's first black newspaper, Freedom's Journal, with its headquarters in New York City. The two editors were both biracial. Samuel Cornish, a Presbyterian preacher, and John Russworm, the third African-American college graduate in the United States. Their mission was to chronicle the uplift of the North's 500,000 free blacks in order to reduce prejudice. The further decrease of prejudice and the amelioration of the condition of thousands of our brethren who are yet in bondage greatly depend on our conducts, the Freedom's Journal said in its opening editorial on March 16, 1827. It is for us to convince the world by uniform propriety of conduct, industry, and economy that we are worthy of esteem and patronage. The editors and the elite blacks they represented often focused, however, on the conduct of the lower classes of our people, whom they blamed for bringing the race down. Class racism dotted the pages of the Freedom's Journal, with articles pitting lower-income blacks against upper-income blacks, and the former being portrayed as inferior to the latter. Cornish and Russworm did sometimes defend low-income blacks. As New York planned to emancipate its remaining captives on July 4, 1827, the mainstream newspapers announced their disapproval. Freed Africans would increase the city's criminal calendar, pauper list, and dandy register, stammered the Morning Chronicle. Cornish and Russworm admonished the newspaper's vulgar attack while agreeing with much of the reasoning behind it. The Africans about to be freed were an injured people, the editors pleaded, and we think it beneath the character of a public editor to add insult to injury. Cornish and Russworm eventually split on colonization, prompting Cornish's resignation. Russworm decided to endorse the American Colonization Society in 1829, dooming his newspaper among anti-colonizationist black America. After putting the first black newspaper to bed, Russworm departed for Liberia, convinced that he had given his all, but he nevertheless had lost the battle against America's racist ideas. He failed to realize that he had contributed to the racist ideas. He had used the first African-American periodical to circulate the ideas of class racism. He had said that lower-income blacks had an inferior work ethic, inferior intelligence, and inferior morality compared to white people and black elites like him. One reason poor blacks were discriminated against was that they were inferior. Russworm had used his paper to circulate the enslaving strategy of uplift suasion, a strategy that compelled free blacks to worry about their every action in front of white people, just as their enslaved brethren worried about their every action in front of their enslavers. The agents of the American Colonization Society practically ignore the ire of most free blacks, and they could afford to do so. Donations streamed into the national office. The Society's annual income leapt from $778 in 1825, about $16,000 in 2014, to $40,000 a decade later, about $904,000 in 2014. State colonization societies sprang up in nearly every western and northern state. But the ACS never attracted its greatest patron saint, Thomas Jefferson. The former president only tracked the development of the ACS from afar. He was suspicious of the organization because he could not stand the Federalists and the Presbyterians behind it. Jefferson may not have supported the ACS, but he never wavered in his support for the colonizationist idea during his final years. Establishing a colony in Africa may introduce among the Aborigines the arts of cultivated life and the blessing of civilization and science, he wrote to historian and future Harvard president Jared Sparks on February 4, 1824. Apparently, black Americans would civilize the continent under the tutelage of those white Americans who had civilized them. It would compensate for the long course of injuries they had endured, Jefferson said. Such that in the end, America would have rendered them perhaps more good than evil. A string of illnesses slowed Jefferson down in 1825. He still read, and he may have perused the first issue of the Society's African Repository and Colonial Journal in March. The issue opened with the history of the ACS, which gave a nod to Jefferson, and ended by speaking of the 400 settlers in Liberia standing in lonely beauty. In another piece entitled Observations on the Early History of the Negro Race, a writer identified as T.R. took aim at polygenesis, who spoke of black people as a separate species incapable of civilization, or the connecting link between men and monkeys. The polygenists must not know, T.R. wrote, that the people who they traduced were for more than 1,000 years the most enlightened on the globe. T.R. cited Jefferson's old friend Count Constantine Volney, the French historian who 40 years earlier had said the ancient Egyptians were of African descent. After several pages passionately demonstrating that the ancient Egyptians were African, T.R. declared that America should carry back by colonies to Africa, now in barbarism, the blessings which were received from her. Civilization was supposedly exhausted in Africa, but awakened in Europe, T.R. stated. But how did the originators of civilization produce such a region of ignorance and barbarism? How did they forget the arts and sciences? These questions were not asked, and they went unanswered. As assimilationists, the only point colonizationists like T.R. tried to make was that since Africans had been civilized in an earlier time, they could be civilized once again. By the time the ACS released the second volume of its periodical in the spring of 1826, Jefferson's health had deteriorated to the point that he could not leave home. By June, he could not leave his bed. Late that month, writer Henry Lee IV, known to Jefferson as the grandson of a Revolutionary War hero, desired a meeting with him. When the bedridden Jefferson learned of Lee's presence, he demanded to see him. The half-brother of future Confederate General Robert E. Lee was Jefferson's last visitor. Jefferson had to decline an invitation to Washington to attend the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. He sent a celebratory statement to Washington instead, saying, "The general spread of the light of science has already laid open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God." His last public words, so sweet to every free person, so bitter to the enslaved. Aside from his Hemings children and Sally Hemings, Jefferson did not free any of the other enslaved people at Monticello. One historian estimated that Jefferson had owned more than 600 slaves over the course of his lifetime. In 1826, he held around 200 people as property, and he was about $100,000 in debt, about $2 million in 2014, an amount so staggering that he knew that once he died, everything and everyone would be sold. On July 2, 1826, Jefferson seemed to be fighting to stay alive. The 83-year-old awoke before dawn on July 4th and beckoned his enslaved house servants. The black faces gathered around his bed. They were probably his final sight, and he gave them his final words. He had come full circle. In his earliest childhood memory, and in his final lucid moment, Jefferson rested in the comfort of slavery. Part 3. William Lloyd Garrison. Chapter 13. Gradual Equality. It was the story of the age, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams dying on July 4, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. No other headline had ever before caused such amazement. Many thought the twin deaths on Freedom Day must have been an act of divine will, an undeniable sign that the United States had the blessing of God Almighty. Newspapers cannot print enough eulogies, anecdotes, letters, statements, and biographical pieces on the two men, whom Benjamin Rush had once called the North and South Poles of the American Revolution. John Adams died in his home in Quincy, due south of the overgrown maritime city of Boston. By the time of Adams' death, Boston had grown to nearly 60,000 people, and was fully immersed in New England's Industrial Revolution, which ran on the wheels of Southern cotton. The odd collection of philosophies, business dealings, denominations, interest groups, and moral movements visitors encountered in the seaside city might have been enough to make them dizzy. But none of the moral movements were trying to stamp out the nation's most immoral institution. The Revolutionary Era abolitionist movement was pretty much dead. Jefferson's fatalism about the difficulty of solving the problem of evil slavery and his habit of deflecting blame for it onto the British had become entrenched across the nation. The convention of abolitionist societies that Benjamin Rush had gathered together in 1794 still existed, but it was no longer much of a force for change. Tiny anti-slavery societies in the Upper South and in the North were being swallowed up by the colonizationists and their racist ideas. Every moral cause seemed to have its day on the annual giving schedule for New England philanthropists. The American Colonization Society imprinted its cause onto America's greatest national holiday, Independence Day. On July 4, 1829, the ACS invited a young newcomer to give the 4th of July address at the distinguished Park Street Church in Boston. Since arriving in the city in 1826, the 23-year-old William Lloyd Garrison had amassed a reputation as a reform-minded, pious, and passionate editor, the usual characteristics of a forthright champion of colonization. His mother, Frances Maria Lloyd, was the source of his piety. She had raised him and his two siblings as a single mother in Newburyport, Massachusetts. They had been poor, but her Baptist faith had brought them through the rough times. He remembered the poverty and her maternal lessons like it was yesterday. When he and his older brother had come home carrying food from their mother's employers or the town's soup kitchen, they had endured a gauntlet of taunts from the richer kids on the street. But Frances Maria Lloyd preached to them about human worth. Though they were low on funds, they were not low as people. His older brother had been a difficult boy to raise, but William Lloyd was a model child, seeking only to please his mother. In 1818, when he was 12, he had begun a 7-year indenture to Ephraim W. Allen, the talented editor of the Newburyport Herald. When he was not busy learning the printing trade or writing letters to his mother, who had moved to Baltimore, he was usually intent on educating himself through reading. He devoured the works of Cotton Mather and tracts by politicians and other clergymen, proclaiming New England's peculiar destiny to civilize the world. He especially enjoyed the novels of Sir Walter Scott, whose heroes changed the world through the might of their character and their readiness to sacrifice their blood for human justice. He also admired the work of the English poet Felicia Hemans, which was praised for its moral purity. William Lloyd Garrison's mother died before his indenture ended in 1825, and one of her final requests to her son that did not involve religion, Frances pleaded with him to remember for your poor mother's sake the black woman, Henny, who had kindly cared for her. Although a slave to man, Frances wrote her son, she is yet a freeborn soul by the grace of God. Freed of his indenture and now skilled in the printing trade, Garrison moved to Boston and secured an editorship at a temperance paper. He had a personal interest in the temperance movement. His absent father had never left liquor, and his older brother had been seduced by it. Garrison probably would have become one of the most notable voices for temperance of the age, but a year before his Independence Day address for the American Colonization Society, an itinerant abolitionist came along to change the course of his life. Garrison first met the Quaker founder and editor of The Genius of Universal Emancipation on March 17, 1828. He sat next to 8 esteemed Boston clergymen listening to Benjamin Lundy in the parlor of his boarding house, which was owned by a local Baptist minister. Up from Baltimore, Lundy was in town raising money for his newspaper and raising support for emancipation. The wrongs of enslavement Lundy spoke about that night wrenched Garrison's heart, and Lundy's activist life, no doubt inspired by John Woolman, thrilled Garrison. The man seemed to be straight out of a Walter Scott novel. He had given speeches in 19 of the 24 states, traveled 12,000 miles, engaged in marathon debates with slave owners, been beaten in Baltimore for his beliefs. Authorities had attempted to suppress his paper. But he had kept saying what he believed. Nothing is wanting but the will. He had continued to publish his crude sketches of slave coffles under the title Hail Columbia and a Stinging Demand, Look at It, Again and Again. While Garrison sat on the edge of his seat, the 8 ministers sat back. They politely listened, but only one offered to help. The others saw nothing to gain and a lot to lose in the cause of emancipation. They feared that a push for emancipation would only cause social disorder. Before the meeting, Garrison, like the lazy minister sitting beside him, probably thought nothing could be done about the evil institution of slavery. It's not that they were in favor of it, but that they thought trying to abolish it was a hopeless cause. As Garrison listened to Lundy, everything changed. Garrison crawled into bed that night enthusiastic about working toward Lundy's aim of provoking gradual, though total, abolition of slavery in the United States. Soon after Lundy's visit, Garrison resigned from his temperance newspaper and thrust himself into the anti-slavery cause. Little did he know that almost four decades would pass before he could stop pressing America to free itself of slavery. Almost from his first words in 1829, agents of the American Colonization Society knew they had selected the wrong Independence Day speaker. "I am sick of our hypocritical cant about the rights of man," Garrison bellowed, making the church crowd uncomfortable. "They should be demanding a gradual abolition of slavery, not promoting colonization." It was a pitiful subterfuge to say that liberation would hurt the enslaved. If enslavement had reduced blacks to brutes, then was it a valid argument to say that therefore they must remain brutes? Freedom and education would elevate blacks to a proper rank in the scale of being. 10 days later, Garrison attended a black Baptist church and participated in the annual celebration of England's abolition of the slave trade. A white clergyman addressed a largely black crowd, lecturing them that emancipation was neither wise nor safe without a long period qualifying blacks for freedom. A murmur of disgust shot from the crowd, and an ACS agent leapt to the speaker's defense. The murmur rang in Garrison's ears as he walked home that night. In the Independence Day address, he had called immediate emancipation a wild vision. But was it really wild? Or was it wilder to stand on some middle ground between sinful slavery and righteous freedom? "I saw there was nothing to stand upon," Garrison admitted. In August, Garrison moved to Baltimore to join Benjamin Lundy and co-edit The Genius of Universal Emancipation. From the editorial page of The Genius of Universal Emancipation, Garrison called for immediate emancipation in September 1829. This new position was not only a change from his own view of 2 months earlier, but a stance more extreme than even Benjamin Lundy's. "No valid excuse can be given for the continuance of the evil of slavery a single hour," he wrote, "not even colonization." Colonization could be used to relieve some enslaved Africans, of course, but as a solution to the problem of slavery, it was altogether inadequate. A disciple of Denmark Vesey agreed, and he let the world know it about 2 months later in November, when he published his appeal to the colored citizens of the world. Anti-slavery activist David Walker was part of the black community in Boston, and Garrison may have already crossed paths with him. "The whites," raised Walker in the pamphlet, "were dragging us around in chains to enrich themselves, believing firmly that black people had been made to serve them forever. Did our Creator make us to be slaves?" he asked. "Unless we try to refute Mr. Jefferson's arguments respecting us, we will only establish them." Walker appealed for black people to refute and resist racism, and he had the anti-racist foresight to see that racism would only end when slavery ended. Walker told enslaved blacks to mobilize themselves for the Second American Revolutionary War. No black person could have read Walker's intoxicating appeal without being moved. And yet Walker watered down his appeal by disparaging the very people he was calling upon to resist. Blacks were the most degraded, wretched, and abject set of beings that ever lived since the world began, he proclaimed. He cited the inhuman system of slavery, black ignorance, preachers, and colonizationists as all being responsible for their present plight. In doing so, he regurgitated the theory of how slavery had made black people inferior. Walker repeated popular racist contrasts of enlightened Europe and wretched Africa, contrasts that had been reproduced by the gradual abolitionists, colonizationists, and the very enslavers who so fervently opposed. Walker did not, however, share his opponent's imaginative version of how enlightened Europe had civilized Africa. He spoke instead of enlightened Europe plunging the ignorant fathers of black people into a wretchedness 10,000 times more intolerable. In Walker's historical racism, Africa was the place where learning had originated in antiquity. It had become a land of ignorance since that time, however, because African people had been disobedient to their maker. Cursed by God, black people lacked political unity, and that lack of unity had enabled their natural enemies in the United States to keep their feet on our throats. David Walker was hardly the first, and he was certainly not the last, black activist to complain about political disunity as a uniquely black problem, as if white abolitionists were not betraying white enslavers, and as if white people were more politically unified, and therefore superior politically and better able to rule. Voting patterns never did quite